Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. What do the billion Muslims across the world really think? The analysis that my guest for this hour, Ahmed Yunus, helped to forge is based on the largest and most in-depth study of its kind, Gallup's recent survey of the Muslim world. Ahmed Yunus is author of American Muslims, War Dear, or Speak the Truth, a post-9/11 look at the debate surrounding American Muslims and their country. He's worked with such figures as Ambassador Dennis Ross and former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to develop long-term strategy to improve U.S. relations with the Muslim world. Ahmed Yunus is one of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world, according to the Royal Islamic Strategic Center. He's senior analyst at the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And he's giving a talk tonight, 6 p.m., on the Utah State University campus, Old Main, Room 119, titled Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? Ahmed Yunus, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Thank you very much. A pleasure is mine.
Let me begin with the book, American Muslims, War Dear. Where'd you get the title?
Oh, that book. Actually, that book I wrote when I was a very young man. It was the summer after my first year of law school, and I had just come to the idea of the voir dire process in a jury where we put citizens in a room and ask them a bunch of questions to ensure that they have no relationship to the topic at hand, and they get themselves on a jury, which is supposed to be of the peers of the defendant. And at that time, recently after 9/11, I felt like the Muslim American community was being asked a series of questions and being investigated in a way in their relationship with terrorism, extremism, violence, Islam, Muslims globally, etc. And I felt like that was the situation of Muslims. So I wrote a book that said, American Muslims, if you're in a voir dire process, speak the truth.
Reading the first sentence from the preface to your book, American Muslims, War Dear, in many ways, the American Muslim identity was among the casualties of the terrorist attacks of September 11th. What did you mean there?
Well, you know, for 30, 40, 50 years prior to 9/11, there was a very concerted effort at erecting a Muslim-American identity that's organic to America and is legitimate within the global understanding of what Muslim life or Muslim identity is. And there were great successes in pursuit of the creation of that Muslim-American identity. And 9/11, in many ways, destroyed much of the success that had come to be, much of the good faith that existed in society, many of the partnerships that had already existed. 9/11 in many ways bolstered Islamophobia and Islamophobes in their attempt to marginalize the Muslim American community. So, you know, at the time, at the age of 21 or 22 when I wrote that book, that's how I felt.
And tell us what American Muslim identity means to you.
Oh, to me, it means to be 100% American and 100% Muslim, that there is neither dissonance nor friction between the founding principles of America and the founding principles of Islam, that this is one of the few countries in the world where one can articulate an authentic Muslim identity freely while being a part and parcel of the leading component of the American fabric or the American pluralism.
And Islam and American plural society, democracy coexisting, that the possibility of that is viewed with some skepticism, according to some of the polling that that you've seen, I'm sure, and have been involved with.
Yeah, there is skepticism of that proposition. I don't know about the polling that you're referring to, but yeah, I mean, I think in general, it's difficult for some Americans with what they see on TV and what they see in Muslim-majority societies as law and custom and culture to believe that one could be fully Muslim and fully American. Just as in history, people thought that would be very difficult for Catholic Americans or for Jewish Americans or for Americans that immigrated from other parts of the world. But, you know, I mean, the largest contingent of Muslim Americans are African-American Muslims. They are not the products of a recent immigrant experience. In fact, they're not the products of a voluntary immigrant experience at all. And the Muslims of America are the only religious group in the whole country that does not have an ethnic or racial majority. So it is the most diverse religious group in all of America. And in many ways, it reflects America's greatness and America's challenges.
So that that journey, you mentioned journey of Catholic Americans.
Yeah.
Do you think Muslim Americans are on that journey, interrupted by the events of 9/11, greater acceptance?
I think 9/11, was a catalytic opportunity for America to get serious, not only about its national security, but also about its identity. And since 9/11, the passing of the ideas of people like Samuel Huntington and the Clash of Civilizations, and that there is a whiteness to American identity or a specific historical narrative to American identity, I think to a certain extent that's begun to wane. And as the economy is challenged and as the average American is challenged by their livelihood and their ability to get a job and their ability to educate their kids, these become the primary issues on the minds and on the frontal lobes of Americans generally. And if the Muslims of America are undergoing the same challenges or trying to become parts of the solutions that will help everyone in American life, then, their integration will succeed. But if American Muslims are seen as a barrier to that, whether a national security barrier or otherwise, for example, in Europe, Muslims are not so much seen as a security barrier, but an employment barrier, that there are so many young people from Muslim-majority societies employed or attempting to gain employment that they oust, if you will, a certain modicum of society generally that's trying to get the same job. You don't have that problem in America. So, of all places in the world where Muslims live as a minority, definitely the data speaks to the proposition that the Muslims of America are doing the best.
The title of your talk, by the way, Ahmed Yunus is my guest. He is senior analyst with the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and the author of American Muslims, Wardir, Speak the Truth. The talk is tonight, 6 o'clock, Old Main 119 is the place on the Utah State University campus. Title of the talk, Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? That is, Mr. Yunus, a very key question.
It is. I think the question itself is problematic. The first question is, what is the Muslim world? There are Muslim majority societies. Less than 20% of the Muslims in the world are Arabs or come from Arab heritage. The largest places where there are Muslims are India, Indonesia, Egypt, and such. There are significant percentages of Muslims living as minorities all over the world, in Brazil, in China, in Europe, in America. There are Muslim-majority societies in Africa. For example, during the presidency of George W. Bush, the highest presidential approval ratings of anywhere in the world, including inside of the United States, was among Muslims in sub-Saharan Africa, because the foreign policy of President Bush towards sub-Saharan Africa was quite positive from their perception. So, the first challenge with that question is, what is the Muslim world?
And so what is the Muslim world?
Well, I
guess it's different. It's different worlds, isn't it?
I think that's the real. There is a global Muslim community. That global community is, tied together by faith, by the narrative of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, by maintaining the necessity of Abrahamic tradition and identity, by holding tight to the Quran and to the five pillars of Islam, but. Is there a global Muslim ummah, if you will, as is many times written in academic literature, a global Muslim community? Yes, there is, but I don't know to what extent it sees itself as aligned together vis-a-vis the rest of the world. I would assume, as most of the data indicates, that human beings see themselves aligned based on their social, economic, cultural dispositions as opposed to geographical dispositions, financial dispositions as opposed to religious identity. So a black Muslim from the inner city of America is probably living a life that's much more similar to a black non-Muslim in the inner city of America than they are living a life that's consistent to a Muslim in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you're involved with is extensive polling. For example, one of the polls was called Who Speaks for Islam? What a Billion Muslims Really Think? And then there's some subsequent polling. I'm guessing you view this as positive, a good step to find out exactly what Muslims think.
Well, that's what we do at Gallup, is we poll people and we give them an opportunity to speak their minds, and we do it in a way that's not activist oriented or advocacy oriented, and we have always, for a very, very long time, actually since the time of George Gallup himself, polled in some Muslim majority societies. Now we at Gallup poll in all 22 countries of the Arab world. I'm pretty sure we poll in all 57 Muslim majority countries of the Organization of Islamic States, and or Islamic Conference, as it was once called. And we do poll significant communities of Muslim minority populations around the world. So we've published a lot of studies on Muslims in Europe, Muslims in America, etc. So yes, I am in favor of polling. I am in favor of people speaking their mind. I mean, many times the disjunct that exists in attempting to change realities that exist in the world is the inability of people to speak for themselves. And one of the scientific tools that we have, survey research, allows us to really remove the heat from conversation and allow people to speak for themselves, against the stereotypes that exist about themselves. And speak for themselves to the people that run their own countries. Many of the societies that we work in, people don't really have much of an opportunity to speak for themselves. And the leadership of their societies and the leadership of their countries and their regions hear their voices through some of the polling that we do. So in my opinion, it's important for people to be heard and for people to have a stake in the direction of the future of their society.
From that polling, are there a couple of bullet points that jump out at you that would surprise people, perhaps, especially in America?
Sure. I mean, when you ask Muslims around the world, what do you admire most about America? Number one, they say freedom, democracy, and participatory government. And number two, they say technological advancement. When you ask Americans the same question about America, they say they have the same answer. So the idea that that we propagated soon after 9/11, they hate us for our freedom. They did this because of our freedom. They brought down the World Trade Center because it stands for freedom. It stands for the ability of this society to push its own values and culture. I think, for the most part, is wrong. Muslims around the world admire most about America what we used to say they hated us for, and have always done so since we started polling. When we asked Muslims around the world, yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm sorry. When we asked Muslims around the world, soon after 9/11, actually, do you believe that 9/11 was completely justified? 94% of respondents around the world said that it was completely unjustified. When we asked them why, most of their answers were based on religion and fill-in-the-blank questions, to the point where some people were quoting the Prophet Muhammad or quoting the Quran. When we asked the people that said that it was completely justified, why, all of their answers were political. They were about, they hit us, so we hit them. They disrespect our dignity, so we take away their dignity. Very worldly, political issues. And we see now, actually, interestingly, after the Arab Spring and the Arab world, that the most anti-Western positions being taken are by the socialist and communist and liberal secular parties, not by the Islamist political parties that exist in the political arena.
But why is that?
Because they adopt the classic kind of post-Cold War anti-imperialism discourse. America's evil. America's trying to manipulate what's happening in the world. Capitalism is a bad thing. They're fighting for the proletariat for egalitarian purposes over the classic kind of socialist anti-government or anti-power discourse. I think the Islamists of the Arab world are much more politically astute than that. We can say maybe they're not as principled, or maybe they're just much more politically astute, depending on what your opinion or position is. But no, the Islamist political parties of the Arab world are very able in engaging with Western nations and Western NGOs and maximizing on what those organizations can bring to their countries.
Has Gallup done polling post-Arab Spring and recently? What are the general, if so, what are the general attitudes across the Arab world and indeed the Muslim world toward the Arab Spring?
Yeah, well, definitely we poll regularly in many of the countries of the Arab world since the Arab Spring. I think the country that we do so most in is Egypt. And what we find overall in a country like Egypt is that there is still very strong support for the revolutions, for the ouster of Hosni Mubarak and his regime. There is still strong support for the trying of Hosni Mubarak and his regime for the crimes that they have committed, financial or otherwise. And there is still a very strong sense, palpable sense, that the people want to see this through. Having said that, the day-to-day realities that people are living have become more difficult. It's more difficult to make ends meet. It's more difficult to get a job. People's perception of whether their local community or place where they live is a good or bad place to get a job is worsening, not improving. Perceptions of Egypt's ability to become a regional leader have waned since the revolution commenced. The perception that protests on the streets are a good thing for the country has started to wane. And there is a general sense that the bread and butter, real, tangible life issues that people brought about revolution for have not been fixed in a real way. And thus we see a lot of ups and downs in the political movements domestically in Egypt, and Islamist parties and secular parties and others beginning to take center stage and to posture themselves against the military, which is still very much ruling what happens. So overall in the Arab world, yes, there is a great appreciation for the Arab Spring. There is a great belief that it is organic. Of course, with varying analysis for varying countries, people's perceptions of what happened in Libya is not the same as people's perceptions of what's happening in Syria, is not the same as what's people's perceptions of what happened in Egypt and Tunisia. But for the most part, there is also a perception that things have not sustained, things have not improved, and that there is need for serious work to bring about that improvement.
Speaking of Syria, that's the flashpoint right now. Do you have a sense of what Muslims are thinking about what's happening in Syria?
Well, let me push back on your question, although I know it's not intended as such. I mean, I don't think there is actually a Muslim opinion on anything. I mean, you know, when you think of a billion point four people, that they don't eat the same food, they don't speak the same language, they don't watch the same TV, they don't drive the same kind of vehicles, they don't like the same kinds of drugs or women or whatever it is. I mean, these are human beings all over the world, and so the proposition that there is an opinion, there isn't. However, in the Arab world, so if we narrow it down to just less than 20% of the Muslims in the world, definitely there is more trepidation about what's happening in Syria than there was in other places. There was not as much support as the West perceived for the military action in Libya. There are many people on the ground that believe that that was for the interests of Western powers, and that was primarily catalyzed because of the natural resources of Libya. Clearly, the Arab world in general thinks that the war in Iraq is a mistake and has moved the whole region backwards. Syria is a very complicated country because it sits in many ways at the crux of the Sunni-Shia tension that exists between Saudi Arabia, Qatar on one side, and Iran on the other side. It's also a very precarious country because it had a strong relationship with Turkey, which is arising as a mediator in the region, but Turkey has since pulled back from Syria because of what it perceives to be brutal tactics. So the Syria situation is different and more complicated than others in that there's a whole regional status quo that is attempting to be maintained by some Gulf powers, and an attempt to become a new player in the region by other powers. And, Hezbollah, Hamas, and a lot of these organizations will be significantly affected by what happens in Syria.
Well, to follow up on it might be a stereotype out there that I unintentionally perpetuated there with
no,
my
you
question.
Didn't, you didn't. I made that clear beforehand.
Yes. But I imagine that's out there. Not only me asking you those types of questions, sort of assuming that there is a Muslim opinion.
Yeah. There is no. I mean, it would be very difficult to you know, like I'm an American Muslim. I'm among, say, you know, low numbers. Say there's 5.5-6 million American Muslims. I can assure you that I've never been in a table where two American Muslims agree on the same thing, and they're both Americans. You know, if you just look at the numbers around the world, say there's 1.3 billion Muslims, say that less than 20% of them are Arab, think that all of Central Asia is Muslim majority, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, all those countries are Muslim majority societies. Think that in Russia there are significant Muslim communities and significant migrant Muslim communities that come from Central Asia. In Central Europe and in Eastern Europe there are significant Muslim populations. In China there is a significant Muslim population. And when I say significant, I mean I'm talking about millions of people, tens of millions of people. So when you look at there's a Muslim every single in every corner of the world. I mean, I think there's even an Islamic center of Yellowknife, Canada. You know what I mean?
Wow.
I mean there's a Muslim everywhere in the world. And what the data in the U.S. shows us, if American Muslims are somewhat of a microcosm of Muslims around the world, what the data tells us is that Muslims have an opinion that's much more consistent with people that look like them and are in the same social and economic disposition as them than they do with, quote-unquote, Muslims. So I'll give you an example. Muslims in India live a very different life than Muslims in Saudi Arabia do or in Qatar do. The Muslims from India and Sri Lanka and Pakistan go to be the servants of the Muslims in the Gulf Arab countries. I assure you these two people do not have the same opinion about the power structure that exists that renders one the master and the other the servant. I think it's really, 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 really important to remember that just as in America, this is the most diverse faith group around, and the diversity of its opinion reflects the diversity of its identity. And the data speaks to that. The data, I mean, when the whole world, when all of the Muslims in the world hated George W. Bush, the Muslims of sub-Saharan Africa loved him.
Yeah, interesting. And that's not, I don't think, as well known.
And that's the benefit of the data, and that's why, you know, as somebody that's been an expert on Muslim opinion my whole life, I've fallen off my chair so many times in my 7 years, 6 years at Gallup. When you look at the data, when you look at the opinion of the people are much more sophisticated than we give them credit for. All people are much more sophisticated than we give them credit for. And much of what we're seeing here at home is indicative of that, whether it be the Occupy movement or the Tea Party, or any other group that is attempting to articulate its place in the American public square. And data gives us an opportunity to hear what they're saying.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. And my guest for the hour is Ahmed Yunus, one of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world, according to the Royal Islamic Strategic Center. He's a senior analyst with the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and author of American Muslims, War Dear, Speak the Truth. The talk tonight at 6 o'clock in Old Main 119, presented by the Religious Studies Program and Political Science Department at Utah State University, is Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? Coming up in the second half of my conversation with Ahmed Yunus, we'll talk about what Muslims in Afghanistan think. We'll also talk about Syria and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through the eyes of those who actually live it. This is based on polling and analysis that Mr. Yunus is involved with. And I'll ask Mr. Yunus a question that crops up often. A perception that moderate Muslims are not pushing back hard enough, not condemning vociferously enough the violent strains of Islam. All of that to come following a brief break.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the folk bluegrass album from Rita Hosking and the affecting new album from Vance Gilbert. I'll also play songs from new releases by Greg Engel, Kate Campbell, and Jenny Bieneman, to name just a few. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. to Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from USU's Anthropology Museum in Old Main, It's free Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, and Saturdays, 10 to 4. This Saturday is a tribute to veterans that includes recorded oral histories. Information is at anthromuseum.usu.edu.
If you just joined us, we're spending the hour with Ahmed Yunus, who is one of the 500 most influential Muslims in the world, according to the Royal Islamic Strategic Center. He's author of a book, American Muslims, Why Dear, Speak the Truth, a post-9/11 look at the debate surrounding American Muslims and their country. He's worked with such figures as Ambassador Dennis Ross and former U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to develop a long-term strategy to improve U.S. relations with the Muslim world. And he is a senior analyst with the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And his talk is titled, Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? That's tonight, 6 o'clock, Old Main 119 on the Utah State University campus. Everyone is welcome, and that is presented by the Religious Studies Program and Political Science Departments at Utah State University. We have, of course, the rest of the hour with Mr. Yunus. One of the aspects of this question, who really speaks for the Muslim world, has to do with an ongoing question which doesn't seem to get settled, and that is a consistent charge against moderate Muslims that they're not speaking out consistently or forcefully enough against extremist elements of Islam, the violence, not speaking out forcefully enough. And I was reading a response that you gave in the Huffington Post. I wonder if you'd respond to that.
Sure. Let's put it into context. The number one victim group of violence by Muslims is Muslims. So let's put that into context. Number one, most people that die at the hands of someone that is engaging in violence that calls himself a Muslim is a Muslim. And so when you go to Muslim-majority societies, that, of course, is not the case at all. The discourse that you're asking me about and that you and I are very familiar with is a Western discourse about the place of minorities. So let's put them to the side for one second, people like me. Let's just take the largest chunk of what we know as Muslim life around the world. Those people live in Muslim-majority societies. And in those societies, there is absolutely no kind of discussion about the use of violence or the killing of innocent people or the blowing up of buses, even if it's in Israel, or the oppression of women, or, you know, I mean, in except for maybe three Muslim-majority countries around the world, these issues are very much resolved at the popular sociological level. At the academic level, intellectually, in terms of Muslim scholarship, I mean, this issue has been resolved for over 1,000 years. The use of violence is only permitted in very clear situations. Those situations very much resemble what you and I would perceive as warfare now. And any sort of use of gratuitous violence or crafty arguments to make a group of people or a person the cause of oppression has been rejected pretty resoundingly. Now, for the Muslims of America, this issue is a lot more problematic because the Muslims of America, you know, I used to be the national director of the Muslim Public Affairs Council before I served at Gallup and before I served in the Bush administration. And in those days, my job was to go on the O'Reilly Factor and on Fox News and on CNN and on MSNBC every single day and react to what's happening on the news. And in those days, much of what was happening on the news was terrorism by Muslims, and we were condemning that terrorism by Muslims. I would posit to you, just because I am an expert on the Muslims of America, the Muslims of America pretty much publish condemnations every single day for every single thing that happens. And a lot of times they publish condemnations just for things that happen, even if it's not by Muslims, just so they can be on the record condemning it. And there comes a point where where historically, about 10 years ago, we were wondering whether it was our inability to speak clearly and eloquently, or it was the inability of the rest of society to listen to what we were saying. Today, the situation is very different. Today, there is a full-fledged movement that attempts to exclude and vilify Muslims in the American public square. These Islamophobes are very well known. Their organizations, the funding that they receive was just exposed in a report by the Center for American Progress by a young lawyer playwright named Wajahat Ali. And so, you know, the Muslims of America have a very unique challenge in that there is a whole industry of Islamophobia that is attempting to exclude them from the American public square. But I would challenge the proposition that there isn't enough condemnation or that there isn't swift enough condemnation. And many people from the Muslim community would challenge the proposition that there needs to be condemnation. We feel that they have absolutely nothing to do with what's happening, that they literally have no connection to the violence that is taking place. And just because they have a religious connection to the person that thinks they're acting pursuant to religion doesn't mean that they have an obligation to condemn, but a lot of people agree that they have an obligation to make sure that their communities know what's going on and young people are not radicalized. And in the American Muslim community, there are a lot of projects around this country that attempt to make sure that, you know, young people are doing what they're supposed to be doing and not getting into trouble and have good mentors and playing sports, etc. So from my own perspective, as an American Muslim, I think this community is doing a great job. From my perspective as an analyst, there's a whole ecosystem that attempts to make Muslims look like they're not doing enough. And I don't know if they condemn as eloquently as they should. I don't know if they're as innovative as they should be in their programming. But definitely none of them support violence, none of them condone violence, and all of them are on record for most acts of violence that have happened in my career and my lifetime as condemning them.
This jumped out at me. This is from your Huffington Post article. It's called Muslim Americans in Pursuit of Justice. It seemed to be dated today, but written in August of last year. I was a little confused by that. But anyway, fairly recent. This has to do with loyalty to America, how specifically Americans of other faith groups see Muslim Americans. And, you know, these are not majorities, but these are fairly high percentages that you quote here. 37% of Protestants, 35% of Catholics, 32% of Mormons say Muslim Americans are not loyal to America.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's a real problem for Muslim Americans. 67% from the same study, 67% of Jewish Americans say that a Muslim American faces prejudice and discrimination on a daily basis. Only 60% of American Muslims agree. So Jewish Americans believe that Muslim Americans are more oppressed than Muslim Americans believe they are, according to our data. So it's interesting, and yes, you're right, that is the data, and yes, that's very problematic for the Muslim American community, and they have a job to do to make it clear what their loyalties are and where they stand and who they stand with. Having said that, when you poll these people, the people that are being talked about or the people that are being perceived, they actually have higher levels of confidence in national American institutions than most non-Muslims do, even in the media, even in the efficacy of the media, the judicial system, the criminal system, et cetera. So, it all depends on what question you're looking at and all depends on how you slice the data. But, yes, there is a significant modicum of skepticism about the loyalty and allegiance of Muslim Americans. And I bet you if you looked at Gallup data from 50, 60 years ago, you would find that they're probably not much different from what people thought about Catholic Americans then.
Mm-hmm. So what's the Muslim American community need to do then? Or do they need to do anything?
I don't know. I mean, you know, from what I see, they're trying to do a lot. I mean, I think now they even have a reality show on television. Not that I watch television, but I hear something like that's happening. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of arts and culture. There's a lot of camps, a lot of young people on TV, a lot of young people in professional sports, a lot of young people in law firms and in government. They got two members of Congress who are Muslim Americans. I mean, you know, the Muslim American community is working really, really hard. But again, you got to remember who you're talking about. You got to remember who you're talking about. The Muslims of America are not a group of immigrants. They certainly are not a group of recent immigrants. And if 38% of them are African Americans and about 20% of them are Arab heritage and about 20% of them are South Asian heritage, you know, the Arabs and the South Asians, statistically, they're probably at the highest levels of income in all of America. The African Americans probably resemble the general African American population in America based on geographic distribution. One of the largest growing communities of Islam in America are Latino Muslims, are Mexican American Muslims. So I don't know when you and I say the Muslims of America and what they need to do to challenge the proposition that they are being perceived as not loyal to America. I don't know. I mean, I think there are a lot of black inner-city communities in America that are not Muslim, that are not really very concerned about whether they're seen as being loyal to America. They are loyal to America. And if you see them as not loyal to America, that really doesn't make any difference to them. There are Armenian communities in Glendale, California. There are Somali communities in Minnesota. There are Polish communities and German communities. And, you know, this is America, and the other's perception of the legitimacy of your identity doesn't carry the day. It certainly carries the branding. It certainly carries the perception. And if you don't want problems for your children in public life, you got to work on that branding and perception. But for that to be the raison d'etre of American Muslims, I think would be a mistake.
Mm. You made reference to that percentage of Muslim Americans who say they face prejudice. That is an interesting fact, that a higher percentage of Jewish Americans believe that most Americans harbor prejudice against Muslim Americans than do Muslim Americans themselves. But 60% of Muslim Americans, do you think that's, from your perception, a lot of Muslim Americans do face prejudice?
I don't know. I mean, I can definitely tell you, as somebody that looks at data, that there is a human factor here. That there are a lot of Muslim Americans that don't want to answer honestly. There are a lot of Muslim Americans that feel like they're being followed by the FBI. There are a lot of Muslim Americans that feel that they're unsafe in their communities. And you know, some of these numbers might be a little lower than they should be. Number one. Number two. You know, sometimes optimism and just being in a community that understands you and appreciates you, and having really good neighbors and your kid being in the right soccer team on Sundays renders you to not face that discrimination. It doesn't mean that the average Muslim is not facing it, and it doesn't mean that that it's not a serious challenge that the community faces on a regular basis. Number three, I mean, Jewish Americans are a group that's been through a lot in American history, in their ability to integrate, in their leadership in the integration of other communities through the civil rights struggle and others. So, you know, it's not a surprise that Jewish Americans are the litmus test for America and its integrity with these issues would be more vocal about the discrimination and disadvantage that Muslim Americans face. Have I ever faced discrimination in America because I'm Muslim? No. I haven't. I face discrimination because I have an afro. I face discrimination because I look Mexican. I face discrimination because I'm young. I face discrimination because I'm in the wrong place with the wrong music playing. I face discrimination because I'm in the wrong neighborhood in the wrong kind of car for the color of my skin. But I've never been discriminated against for being a Muslim or being an Arab. And I don't know if the legitimacy of my testimony is equal to that of a woman that wears a headscarf.
Mm. If you just joined us, we're speaking this hour with Ahmed Yunus, who is giving a talk presented by the Religious Studies Program and Political Science Departments at Utah State University. It's called Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? It's tonight at 6 p.m., Old Main, Room 119 on the Utah State University campus. Everyone is welcome. Ahmed Yunus is Senior Analyst with the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies and author of American Muslim, Bardir, Speak the Truth. We are on tape in this part of the program, so no phone calls today. I'm looking at, I think this is the latest big study from Gallup on this, measuring the state of Muslim-West relations, assessing a new beginning.
Sure.
And a couple things stood out to me. One is differences among the Muslim world. This goes to your point that the Muslim world is not a monolith. Difference among various Muslims around the world, to the point of whether political differences or religious differences are the cause of Muslim-West tensions. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of times when we probe with the questions that we develop at Gallup, we find that we're getting to a place where everyone's using a word and we don't know if they're all using the same word or not. When we used to ask about Muslim-West tensions or the beef that Muslims globally had with America, a lot of times we would get to a place where people would say, we want America to show more respect. We want America to show more respect. And the more we relayed that piece of information, the more we were challenged with the question, well, what on God's earth does it mean for us to respect them? I mean, do they want us to become Muslim, or do they want us to stop throwing the Quran down the toilet at Guantanamo Bay? Do they want us to stop, you know, taking horrific pictures like we did mistakenly in Iraq or in Afghanistan? What do these people want in order for us to be evoking respect? Which is a very fair question. Very fair question. Okay. You want respect, what is it that you want? So what, we would go back and we asked, what do you mean by respect? Do you mean 1, 2, 3, or 4? And this reality is a very similar reality, where the definition of these terms and what people mean when they say it's a religious source for the conflict or it's a political source for the conflict, what is it that they mean when they say this? The reason we began to probe that is because we found time and time and time again, when we tried to probe those that had antagonism towards America and Muslim-majority societies, we found them to be secular. And we found the reasons to be secular. And when we attempted to probe the reason why people seem to not be as antagonistic towards America, we find that the answer was usually religious. Or a lot more spiritual in orientation than political, worldly analysis. And so we attempted to probe a little bit more. I mean, I give an example of where else we do this. A lot of our work in the Arab world is about job creation for young people. And we asked young people, do you plan to start a job in the next 12 months? And we found that 33% of young people, 15 to 29 in the Arab world, 22 countries of the Arab world, said that they plan to start a job in the next 12 months. And only 4% of Americans the same age said the same. So 33% of Arabs, 15 to 29, want to start a business in the next 12 months. But only 4% of American and European young people same age say the same thing. Well, why could that be? When we would give those briefings, people would say, well, it's because they can't find any food, they can't find any jobs, so they create their own liquor store, or they create their own gum shack. So we went back and asked, are you a necessity-driven entrepreneur? Are you an opportunity-driven entrepreneur? Are you somebody that is an entrepreneur because you ain't got no other job, you can't find another job? Or are you an entrepreneur because you have an idea, because you believe that there's an opportunity in a market or for your family or what have you? And we began to see that your level of education was not proportional in any way to whether you are an opportunity-driven entrepreneur or a necessity-driven entrepreneur, that there is really an entrepreneurial spark, if you will, that exists in the 22 countries of the Arab world that is at a much higher level than the rest of the world. So the same for, do you think that the reason the West and Muslim-majority countries are having a problem is religion, or do you think it's politics, it's an attempt to get at, what do you really mean when you're answering these questions? Hmm.
And there are differences in the answers, for example, in the region, Middle East and North Africa versus Sub-Saharan Africa and other places, I think.
You know, it's fascinating. I tell you something that's not from the data, that's just from my own kind of hunch of reading a lot of data. The further you go from, I'll give you an example, the further you go from Palestine physically, geographically, and Muslim public opinion, the more aggressive the opinions are. The further you go from Palestine, the more aggressive the opinions are, whether it's vis-a-vis Israel or what should happen for the Palestinians or the legitimacy of the use of violence or self-defense or what have you. And some of this is explained sociologically, which is, you know, a lot of times those people are not Arabs. They don't understand the intricacies of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. They don't know Palestinians. They see Palestinians as kind of a symbolic community or a symbolic force in society or in nature, but they don't necessarily see them as kind of, you know, Palestinians as opposed to Jordanians as opposed to Syrians. They have a way. They are a people. They are known. They are a known commodity, etc. So part of it is the sociology of just not being there, not being an Arab, not being a part of the back and forth of what's happening in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. A second part of it is also sourced in not being there. You don't necessarily have any family that's fought in these wars, so your valuation of whether there should be more war or more dying or more, you know, you don't value it the same, just like there's a lot of difference in public opinion between Palestinians and the rest of Arabs. So between the rest of Arabs and Muslims generally, there's a significant amount of difference. The same thing, if you will, as it relates to these issues of politics or religion. A lot of times the societies that choose religion are either societies that are nascent in the development of their Muslim identity, or societies that have a bit of distance from what they perceive to be the source or the authenticity or authentication of Muslim identity, which is probably Saudi Arabia and Mecca and Medina. And that would be, I think, one of the explanations for why you see a variation in the data.
That is interesting. The further away you get, the more aggressive the opinions get.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you went to Peshawar, Pakistan, and you asked about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, you would get significantly more aggressive opinion than if you went to any country in the Arab world. Any country in the Arab world.
And by aggressive, you mean what, harder line?
Yeah, harder line on everything, on everything. I mean, there would just be a greater willingness to be aggressive, to be harder line, to be more conservative of your opinion.
I want to ask you, we just have a few minutes left, part of this study would be very interesting, I think, to people, what Afghans think on the war in Afghanistan. Of course, we tend to see it through the prism of our perspective here in the United States. What are some of the key opinions that Afghans have on the war in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't have that data in front of me, so I have to be totally honest with you and tell you that I can't pull that off the top of my head. But certainly, in Afghanistan, for the most part, there is much greater diversity on what's happening in Afghanistan than in any Muslim-majority society otherwise, and much of our polling in Afghanistan is done to ensure that we're understanding what tribes and what families and what relationships are articulating opinion at different points in time throughout our polling. And that's kind of, you know, that's one step above my level of knowledge.
Hmm. Just generally, in some of the countries, maybe taking the countries in Middle East and Northern Africa, where we've had the Arab Spring, I'm curious about the differences among the population in some of those countries versus what the West wants. And I think we can say, you know, the United States and several of its allies, what people would generally want is for these countries to become pluralistic democracies.
Mm.
And I don't know whether, take Egypt or Tunisia or some of these countries, is that matchup with fair exactness with what they want?
Absolutely, absolutely. And even if you were to look to Afghanistan, even if you were to look to Pakistan, even if you were to look to some of the South Asian countries, absolutely, the overwhelming trajectory of opinion and emotion outside of the few Gulf Arab states in Muslim-majority societies all over the world is absolutely freedom and democracy, participatory government, equality between men and women. Should men and women have equal legal rights? Absolutely. Should there be freedom of speech in the Constitution? Absolutely. Should there be freedom of religion for non-Muslims? Absolutely. These are things that we've pulled on consistently for almost a decade now in almost a majority society. I mean, the general trajectory is absolutely towards freedom and democracy. For God's sakes, even the Islamist political parties in the Arab Spring are fighting for freedom and democracy. I mean, even the guys that aren't supposed to be for freedom and democracy are for democracy. So, you know, these societies will be ruled by participatory government. And these societies will have something that looks like what we believe is democracy. It will be consistent with their way of life. That does not mean that there will be rights and freedoms that are curtailed. It means that rights and freedoms will be articulated in a way that is consistent with everyone's faith and everyone's culture and everyone's way of life. And I do believe that even in Afghanistan, even in Pakistan, these are all countries that are moving towards democratic structures and free societies. The challenges, the security for society and security for the populations en route to that goal. And much of what we see in Egypt as a litmus for post-revolutionary realities is that the more unsustainability there is in, if you will, bread and butter issues, making ends meet type of issues, there will still be a hope for democracy and freedom. But people will begin to worry a little bit about what it is that they're fighting for and the potential stability of what it is that they win at the end of a war that they win. But there is no doubt that Gallup data speaks unequivocally to the proposition that Muslims around the world want freedom They want democracy. They want equality for men and women legally, and they want freedom for religious minorities. And they even say that vis-a-vis the constitutions that they would want to create in the future for their countries.
So you are hopeful this will sweep eventually the Muslim world? And I'm thinking things don't look very hopeful right now in Syria.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't know about sweep. I don't know to what extent these revolutions are necessarily connected. You know, Syria, again, is a very unique situation. Partly because the leader of the country isn't really running much of the country, partly because of the role of the Ba'ath army and the Ba'ath presence in government, et cetera. But yes, absolutely. I believe that the end of this period of turmoil is something that is very close to democracy and freedom. Part of that is not, let me close with this. Part of that is not me being an analyst, and part of that is not me looking at data. Part of that is me just knowing that that's the natural trajectory of God's creation on earth. I'll speak as a Muslim, not as an analyst or as an academic. I do not believe that God would bring us to earth if we weren't eventually going to figure it out or get as close as possible to figuring it out. And to allow each human being to articulate dignity, the dignity that's bestowed by God, the dignity that reflects the dignity of the Lord, the Creator, there has to be freedom, and there has to be an ability of people to speak their minds, and there has to be the creation of societies that chart a course that's based on people coming together and compromising and making decisions together. And I just don't believe fundamentally, viscerally, that the trajectory of mankind is towards oppression, because then it wouldn't be towards God.
Mm. Well, we have spent the hour with Ahmed Yunus. Appreciate you taking some time to be with us. His talk.
An honor for me.
Thank you. The talk tonight at 6 o'clock in Old Main, room 119 on the Utah State University campus, is Who Really Speaks for the Muslim World? Ahmed Yunus is a senior analyst with the Gallup Center for Muslim Studies. And that talk is presented by the Religious Studies Program and Political Science Departments at Utah State University. Ahmed Yunus, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. And we thank you for listening to Access Utah. By the way, tomorrow, my guest is Aaron Gruel. You may have seen the movie starring Hilary Swank, Freedom Riders. And we'll talk with the woman behind that movie. Aaron Gruel is coming to Utah State University as a guest of the Utah State University M. Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. They're presenting A Night with Aaron Gruel, The Freedom Riders' Diary. That's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock in the Taggart Student Center. This is what Aaron Gruel writes. When I walked into my first class as a new teacher, I could not have been less prepared to deal with the harsh realities in the lives of my students or the way the outside world would crash into my classroom. Those teenagers lived in a racially divided community, were already hardened by firsthand exposure to gang violence, broken homes, juvenile halls, and drugs. Their lives were changed by reading several books, including The Diary of Anne Frank. Aaron Gruel, my guest, tomorrow on the program.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the law firm of Hilliard, Anderson & Olson, with offices at the Riverwoods Business Complex at 600 South Main in Logan. Concentrated practice areas include family, employment, and immigration law. Information is online at hao-law.com.